I'm Robert Siegel, and this is The Connection. This week, Los Angeles police officers began a pilot program with handheld computers in which they record the race of every person they pull over. The program is part of a federal consent decree aimed at reforming the controversy-ridden force, but the program itself is also pretty controversial. It is meant to record racial perceptions, not necessarily reality, in an effort to provide hard numbers to the anecdotal evidence of racial profiling. Your race in this case really doesn't matter. What matters is what an officer was thinking as he or she turned on the siren. But quantifying perception has become one of the many problems for the hundreds of police departments in the relatively new numbers fight against racial profiling. Connection listeners, do you think that racial profiling is, as it's been called, the civil rights issue of today and is getting the numbers the key to the fight? Or are we obscuring with statistics a practice that calls for wider reforms in the criminal justice system? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined in the studio by Northeastern Professor of Criminal Justice Policy Jack McDevitt, who co-wrote a guide on best practices in racial data collection for the U.S. Department of Justice. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you, Robert.
And joining me on the line from Oakland, California, Ron Davis, who is police captain and head of the Racial Profiling Task Force for the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. Hi, Ron.
Good morning.
And on the line from New York, we have Heather McDonald, who's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, and she is the author of a recent article entitled The Myth of Racial Profiling. Heather McDonald, welcome to The Connection.
Thanks for having me on, Robert.
Well, I'm going to start first with Jack McDevitt, and I want to ask you about the numbers. It's only very recent that law enforcers began this kind of data collection with an eye toward racial profiling. Why are they doing it now, and give us a bit of a timeline here.
Sure. I mean, I think that the allegations of police disparate enforcement of laws has gone back for many, many, many years. What we've seen recently, starting in the mid-1990s, was some courts stepped in, particularly in New Jersey and Maryland, to say, well, there's all these allegations, but we don't really have any hard data. We don't have anything other than one side saying it happens and the other side saying it doesn't. So as part of the court decrees, they've asked different police forces to start to collect information about these stops. That happened in the middle 1990s. And then in the late 1999 was particularly the big year. A number of state legislatures went into the act and said that they would require police departments in their jurisdictions, and some jurisdictions voluntarily, because the police leaders, the police chiefs in those jurisdictions said, I don't really know what's going on with traffic stops, and I'd like to know it in my jurisdiction. So literally now we have 400 to 500 jurisdictions across the country collecting information about the characteristics of traffic stops in their jurisdiction.
And in these cases, police officers are self-reporting whom they're stopping.
Absolutely. That's one of the sticky issues in this, is how do you get the race? I mean, one thing we have to always remember is that race is a social construction anyway. What one person may self-define as being black or Latino, another person may think of themselves as multiracial or a variety of different ways. But what happens when you try to operationalize this kind of data collection, what happens is that you have to think about the interaction at the car. The most important thing is keeping the officer safe. That's the number one priority in all of this. And to have the interaction at the car be professional between the person in the car and the officer. So what you end up with is we end up with asking a police officer, should he ask the person their race? I've pulled you over.
Yes.
I've stopped you. And I'm now going to say,
I can't tell. Are you Filipino or Central
right.
American?
And now I'm going to fill it in. And a person in a car would rightly say, well, what difference does that make to whether or not I was speeding?
Mm-hmm.
So what almost every jurisdiction has done is gone to the perception of the officer. They just take the perception of the officer. And if you think to the allegations, that's probably a fairly reasonable thing to do, because the allegations are that police perceive one group to be engaged in behavior differently, and their perceptions then drive their actions to stop that group.
So if Tiger Woods is stopped on the highway,
right,
should he ever have to drive his own car again in his life? The question is not whether he indeed is as much Thai as he is African-American, but did the officer stopping him simply assume he was black?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Now, are you confident that one can devise systems in which you can come up with a solid answer, a statistical answer that says there is disproportionate stopping of people of one minority or another, racial profiling is at work and at work insidiously?
No. And I've written with the team of Debbie Ramirez and Amy Farrow, we've written a guide as to how to collect this data. But the data is only one part of a process. We can't start thinking that one number is going to tell us, all right, this officer does it or this jurisdiction does it and this jurisdiction doesn't. These numbers are part of an overall process where police departments start to understand this behavior more and they talk to their community about the behavior. Not one number. This isn't going to be there's a good person and a bad person, a good officer and a bad officer. There's going to be a million shades of gray and a million contexts in which this kind of decisions are being put in.
Let's turn to Ron Davis in Oakland, California. You're a police captain. When police officers make those stops on the highway, in your experience, are they sometimes, or often for that matter, acting on the race of the motorist?
Well, what I think when we talk about racial profiling is what we're really talking about is bias. And depending on the bias and stereotypes that we bring to the job, which we learn on the job, and I have to offer that a lot of time experience is the greatest creator of bias. And so there are stops in which bias would dictate why this person is selected, with all things being equal. But I really have to stress that it's my opinion that this application of bias in most cases is unintentional. And it's based on some of the stereotypes in our society that minorities commit more crime, that minorities are more likely to carry narcotics or contraband. And so on the roadway, when the officers are conducting their stops, it could play a factor. In other words, if you have two speeding cars and one is white and one is a minority, and you have a stereotype that minorities carry more drugs, then you might tend to stop minorities more often. And I think that's one of the importance of data collection, is to identify if we are applying these biases. And so I think it does occur.
But if, in fact, your department has guidance from the Drug Enforcement Administration that Jamaicans, men who might likely wear dreadlocks, might well be the drug couriers on the highway near you, police officers might be on the lookout for that, and they would regard that, I gather, as intelligence, not as bias.
Well, you know, it's like anything else. If you have a small percentage of any group that's committing a crime, you cannot apply that to the entire group. And so if there's some intelligence, if you want to call it, that Jamaicans with dreadlocks are couriers of narcotics, that does not give you the probable cause or the legal justification now to stop every Jamaican with dreadlocks, because that small percentage who are couriers does not represent the entire community. And I think we're then getting into constitutional violations, because if I'm Jamaican with dreadlocks coming home, I should not be subjected to a stop and search because a small percentage of my race is engaged in criminal activity.
On the other hand, the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit gives police officers the opportunity to stop nearly anybody on the highway, to begin with, for speeding, and then search them.
Well, most definitely. I mean, I think most officers would tell you the vehicle code in most states are several thousand pages, and give me 5 minutes in a car and I can find the violation. And that's one of the complaints people have with pretextual stops. Now, the Supreme Court has made it clear that pretextual stops are legal, but I would submit they're not legal if they're used to conduct racial profiling or race-based stops. And so the idea is, if you have this stereotype and you pull behind a minority person and you believe this person is carrying contraband or narcotics because of their race, well, then you'll find a legal cause. And that's what makes racial profiling so hard to quantify as far as allegations and complaints, because when the citizen makes the complaint, there's usually, in most cases, a legal justification for the stop. So it's not as simple as violation population, because you can always find a reason for the stop. The question is, are officers applying biases and stereotypes when they're making their decisions to enforce the law? And are they basing this on, like, say, false information? And I would also suggest that the information, the statistics are showing that minorities are not more likely to carry narcotics or contraband, and that what we call the hit rate is consistent between the races. And so what happens is, if you stop more minorities, you will arrest more minorities, you will incarcerate more minorities, and then we use that incarceration rate to say that minorities are committing more crime. So it starts a cycle that then justifies, or many will offer to justify, racial profiling.
And by hit rate here, you're talking about the number of times that a search produces some contraband, either
correct,
narcotics or a firearm. Anything else that I'm missing here that might turn up in such a situation?
No, it's basically narcotics, some type of contraband. And like you said, the hit rates are, as we call the hit rates, are consistent. So that belief that minorities commit more crime is just false. As a police manager, I would tell you this too. It's probably the most ineffective strategy I can think of. If you look at some of the operations, Operation Pipelines, I mean, people are conducting 34,000 car stops and then arresting 700 narcotics dealers based on a profile offered by the DEA. Now, where I come from, that's about a 2.5% hit rate, success rate. And I would say that's very ineffective, and we should not accept that. I mean, if you went to a doctor and he told you that this operation has a 2% chance of succeeding, you wouldn't take that. So why we keep we're forcing officers to get on our roadways in this country and to start guessing, not based on any intelligence, any strategic response, and to try to determine who might have narcotics, contraband. And you can't do that without applying a stereotype and a bias. And so we have to change, we really have to reform the way we police. We have to change operational systems. And I think that is the key, and data collection is one step toward that. I have to agree with Jack wholeheartedly that it's not the answer to everything, but it does go towards managerial effectiveness.
Yeah. You, Ron Davis, Captain Davis, and Jack McDevitt agree on a good deal here. And now, I'm sorry to ruin the unanimity here, but Heather McDonald in New York City is not in quite such accord. You've written about the myth of racial profiling. What is it that Jack and Ron are getting wrong here?
Actually, I agree with a lot of what they say. I have a few little quibbles, which we can get to, but I certainly agree with Jack that with his skepticism that we are going to be able to generate a number that is adequate to the complexity of policing that will tell us whether there is selective prosecution and enforcement going on. And I think we should talk a little bit further about the difficulties. We've been talking about what goes into the numerator, you know, how you make the designations of who's been stopped. But the bigger, far bigger problem is what goes into the denominator, what we compare the stop or search data to. And that is where the real nightmare occurs. But I also agree with Mr. Davis completely that the initial traffic stop should be colorblind. But I think the racial profiling debate in this country has been very conceptually muddled, and you have to distinguish the context in which the charge is made. First, we have the initial decision to pull over a car. And as far as I'm concerned, throwing race into that decision is completely unfair. You don't have a heck of a lot to go on. If you're doing your drug interdiction by deciding who to pull over, all you've got basically is make of car. You know, the DEA will publish reports saying, well, these days, marijuana posses are favoring Nissan Pathfinders. You've got the direction, and you've got race. That's just too unfair to minority drivers. But then we have a completely different context, which is the car has been stopped, and the trooper is observing the occupants. And this is where we have the search data. And there, I think that race can be one very, very small element if you have credible information about, at this point, there is a Colombian posse bringing in heroin on the New Jersey Turnpike. That can come into play, but I think what's important to realize is that troopers at that point have a whole set of non-racial cues that they're looking for in deciding whether to search that car. Frequently, the passengers and the drivers don't know each other's names, or they disagree on their destination point or why they're on the road. Troopers can see whether the vehicle compartments have been scratched or monkeyed with because they've been turned into traps for drugs or for weapons.
And those actually would be signs that go well beyond the ethnicity or the race of the people in the car. We're going to continue on that very point. We've been listening just now to Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research in New York City. We're also talking with Jack McDevitt of Northeastern University and Ron Davis of the Oakland Police and the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. We're all talking about racial profiling on The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11, host Robert Siegel talks about natural...
It's The Connection. I'm Robert Siegel. The number 800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The topic this hour is racial profiling. Jim is calling from Iowa City. Jim?
Yes, sir. About 3 years ago, I had to work late, and it was night, and I felt sorry. My wife and kids had been in the house all day, so I had to go to the grocery store in town. We live in a community just a few miles from Iowa City. Iowa City, Corleville area, and I got our groceries, and I was driving home, and I drove through this rich neighborhood, and all of a sudden this car pulls up behind me, and follows me wherever I turn, follows me all through this neighborhood, and then about 2 miles out into the country, And then all of a sudden the guy's lights come on. I look at my speedometer. I wasn't speeding, but, you know, it scared the heck out of my wife and I, because we're wondering, who's this person following us? We couldn't tell because they're so close behind us. And I said to the officer, what are you pulling me over for? I wasn't drinking, wasn't speeding. What are you pulling me over for? And he said, wouldn't tell me first. And then another officer shows up and says, well, I pulled you over because you crossed the center of the road. And I said, well, you scared the heck out of us. We're driving along, couldn't tell who's following us. You're following us. We're all the way through Brown Deer Run, clear out into the country. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, just getting my family some groceries and taking them for a ride. And he said, okay, well, I'm not going to give you a ticket, but perhaps you should choose an alternate route home. Now, why did he say that? Because I was, at the time, I had an old, rusted-out van that was about 13, 14 years old. Was he pulling me over because I looked poor driving through a rich neighborhood, or did he pull me over because my wife was sitting in the front with me is Hispanic, you know?
And
inappropriate. I'm not saying all the Coralville police are that way by any means, but it just made me think, and I called in the next day and complained to the Coralville Police Department about, you know, the comment that was made. And like I say, I'm not saying all Coralville police or all police in general, but just sometimes I think cops see somebody, and if they're driving an old vehicle through a rich neighborhood, or they don't look, you know, their skin color doesn't match the other people in the neighborhood, I think sometimes they look for an excuse to pull people over.
And Jim, if I saw you driving, would I assume that you are white or Asian or black or Latino?
I'm Caucasian, and my wife's Hispanic.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling.
Robert, the
Jack McDevitt, yes.
What Jim just said, those stories just reverberate. I go around the country and do training with police and with community
members. Although that wasn't necessarily a racial profiling problem at all.
Exactly. But one of the important elements here is this whole notion of place and being out of place. Mm-hmm. And what Jim was describing, there's a study that was done in Detroit, and they showed that for communities that bordered Detroit, the further you get away from the Detroit border, the more likely an African-American is going to be stopped because they're in an all-white neighborhood. And we've seen that all around. We did some work in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and people talked about the fact that the police admitted that they will pull somebody over who's African-American at 1 o'clock in the morning because they don't recognize them. They seem out of place.
Well,
and this whole
yes, Heather McDonald, yes.
I mean, you also get whites coming into Bedford-Stuyvesant who will be stopped by the police. And I think, you know, again, the initial decision to stop probably should be based simply on traffic violation. And Jim did admit, he didn't admit to crossing over the line, but the police officer had some credible reason to stop him. But I think we sort of do have to decide in this country, how much do we want to trust officers' experience? And it sometimes is going to be based on groups, you know, and seeing when something is out of place. And maybe we don't think that the war on drugs is worth the cost and want to completely back off from something like that. But again, I mean, that was an interesting story because it's not always a racial issue. It's based on what the officer is seeing, and whether that does fit in to what he's expecting in the neighborhood.
I'd like to put a question to Ron Davis, yes. But I'd like to frame the question this way, though, Mr. Davis. Can you imagine an order going out to your police department in Oakland, let's say, that somehow sums up what the correction is? That is, what do you tell people? Don't stop so many black drivers, or make sure you stop some white drivers to get the numbers better? What is it that you say to try to correct this practice?
You say you stop people for their behavior, not their association or their race. And I have to say this with the caller. There was a key thing. It's possibly racial profiling because he had a minority in the car.
Yes, his wife was Hispanic.
Right.
Assuming that was evident to the officer, yeah.
Here's the other thing, too. Racial profiling is not, it can be all races. That's why I talked about bias. And so it can be a non-minority, a white person coming into a minority neighborhood is an assumption that he or she is buying narcotics or engaging in illegal activity. It's, once again, it's these biases, these assumptions that we have to stop applying to law enforcement. Now, I disagree with Heather about the race can be considered after stop. Here's what a profile should do. If you get a profile from the DEA or some intelligence agency that tells you that Jamaicans or blacks or Asians are carrying drugs, it should serve to alert the officer. It does not constitute probable cause, which means you're alert and your observation skills are toned and you make your own independent probable cause to collaborate that profile. It does not mean you consider that race or that when you're making the stop.
Oh, I completely agree. Oh, that's
right.
Fine. As long as I think we still need that information. I think what I'm seeing in some jurisdictions is they're not even allowing officers to know the race of violent felons because they're so worried that this is going to play into some sort of racial profiling. I would totally, again, agree. You are looking at behavior. You're looking, are the drivers and passengers nervous? Do they have the luggage that is sufficient for the trip they say they're on?
Correct.
Do they have plates from a drugstore state? So I completely agree with Ron on that. I would disagree, however. He says that the identical hit rates for contraband for minorities and whites show that there's an equal rate of carrying. I see those numbers just the opposite. It is true in New Jersey, for instance, blacks were 53% of the searches in one data set. And the data set was, frankly, lousy. But let's just take that number for argument. And whites were about 20%. But the hit rates were identical. Now, if they were to search whites at 50% and blacks down to 23%, the hit rates would change radically.
But isn't there another important point here, that those hit rates, I recall, were about 30% from one
right.
part of the document dump.
Right.
That means that 70% of the people being stopped are producing nothing in the search.
30% is a pretty darn good hit rate, actually.
But it's a good hit rate, but it also means there are lots of people who are experiencing what can be a fairly humiliating encounter with law enforcement.
Well, then that's a question society has to answer, is do we think it's worth the cost?
There's
independent evidence of who's doing drugs or trafficking in drugs out there.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. You know, the ACLU has an argument, and I think Ron alluded to this, which is it's all circular. You have biased officers that are only looking for black and Hispanic traffickers, and that's who they're going to arrest, and that's who's going to be in the prisons. That tells you nothing about who's actually carrying drugs. That's a very plausible argument. So you need other types of evidence. And if you look at homicides from drug turf wars, or homicides in drug-induced brawls, nobody's claiming that the homicide data is the basis of racial profiling.
But it is disproportionately black
and
Hispanic.
Percentage of blacks who are victims and perpetrators of drug war homicides, 63%. We have about 60% in state prisons for drug trafficking. So to me, that suggests that actually the police are sort of going for where the violent drugs trade.
Robert, I want to hear one quick word from Ron Noble, and then we're going to bring in another guest for this hour. Yes, Ron.
Here's the problem with the, even if, let's say, the statistics that Heather talked about are accurate. What we're finding out with these car stops and these stops, that the arrest rates are around 3 to 10%. So if we're using car stops to address violent crime, well, then excuse the phrase, we ain't catching them, which means we're being very ineffective. Also, in this country, we have to accept this. Safe streets, our civil liberties can never be compromised for safe streets. If we want to reduce crime and do things of that nature, well, if we suspend the Constitution, we can reduce crime by 50%. That's not what this country is about.
Sure.
And so when I took my oath of office, it had nothing in there about crime reduction.
Okay.
Crime reduction is not the police. My oath is to protect the Constitution, not to reduce crime.
That's Ron Davis from NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and Heather McDonald from the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. Jack McDevitt of Northeastern University is in the studio. And Raquel de la Rocha is on the line from Los Angeles. She is the president of the Los Angeles Police Commissioners Board, which is the board that oversees the L.A. PD, where you do have people who are going out with the handheld computers either now or very soon to start asking people or recording without asking people what their race is. Do you actually think that that's going to produce some very important data and an answer that can help you cure this this problem?
Well, I have. Obviously, we're required to do this under the consent decree, which hasn't been signed yet, but we have already started doing it as of Sunday. And I have serious concerns about the actual input of the data, that it's fundamentally flawed, not just because, of course, they're guessing. Everybody accepts that the officers have to guess the race because it would be a violation of people's sense of their privacy to go around asking. It would create a whole other ball of problems. But my concern is that what we're really after here is whether bias played a role in that decision to pull the car over or the pedestrian over, right? That's what we want to know.
But
what we're having the officer do is record the person's race or ethnicity at the very end of the encounter. So those important clues as to what that national origin or race is, such as their name, their accent, an up-close view of their facial characteristics and their skin color, none of that actually is known to the officer when they first decide to put on that flashing red light. And similarly, most of the what people consider the offensive contacts to be, such as searches or what we call proning people out, making them lay on the pavement for security purposes, at that point, that's very early in the contact. Again, the officer doesn't know the name, hasn't taken a good look at the person. And at the very end of all this, they're going to take their Palm Pilot and they're going to make a distinction between someone being Asian American or Pacific Islander or Middle Eastern. And that's going to be recorded as if that played a role in those decisions. And that's my concern, is how are we going to then analyze that data later? As Heather McDonald pointed out, there's a benchmarking problem.
Yes. Well, Jack McDevitt, is there a benchmarking solution, or is this an insoluble problem?
Well, I don't think we have a really good solution yet. We have better ways to do it. The worst way to do it has been done so far, which is to compare it to 11, 12-year-old census data. Right. Now we can compare it to more recent census data, or you can compare it to the driving population on the road, or better yet, to the people who are violating laws on the road. And all of these get better, but they're not perfect. But one thing that is important to understand here is that you do record the reason for the stop. That's one of the things that goes on all these forms. Why did I pull this person over? Mm-hmm. And we need to be able to understand that reason for the stop. Was it a taillight out? Was it the person that was speeding 30 miles over the speed limit? Those are very different kinds of cases. And what we see is, in some jurisdictions, you see differences by the race, by who's being pulled over for these sort of more discretionary type stops than people who are pulled over for less discretionary stops.
Well, we've also seen in New Jersey, in one data set, that at night stops, and it's an empirical question whether the police can see at night. I tend to believe that they can't, especially with tinted windows. The proportion of blacks stopped actually goes up. But I think we should talk a little bit more about this benchmark problem, because
before we lose Ricardo Rocha, I want to ask her just for a moment about those categories in the Palm Pilot. Or is it a Palm Pilot, or am I using a generic term?
We're trying two different Palm Pilots, and we're also doing a paper recording. But
I see it.
My concern is everybody's dialogue is about black versus white, and in Los Angeles, it's much more complex.
Mm-hmm.
We have, as you say, so many categories. And the issue is, we're assuming that what gets recorded somehow shows what was in the mind of the officer back when they made this decision. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to totally cloud the issue, because you're going to have much more exact data. Again, it's a guess, but at least it's closer to being specific than the officer who was in a car behind a car who's looking at the back of people's heads. In Los Angeles, so many of us are different shades of brown. Because we're out in the sun all day long. Most of us have dark hair. We bleached our hair a different color. You know, nobody's who they truly would naturally have looked like, because we've all been altered some way. And we're multiracial. I'm multiracial. A lot of us are very mixed. And so what is this data going to show?
Hey, Robert?
Yes, that's Ron Noble. Thank you very much, Ricardo de Rocha. Ron Noble from Oakland.
Yeah, if one who's done a lot of car stops. In many cases, you can't. And one of the challenges is, I know we put on our form, is to ask the officer, can you tell the race at the time of the stop? And I agree with Heather about the nighttime stops. But as far as getting specific to multi-ethnicities, I think that's not the issue. What you want to know is, did the officer think the person was of color, black or white, at the time of the stop? Because was this the point where bias played a key role?
Yeah, but can we just get real here for a moment? If I'm a police officer and my numbers are too high and on the black or Latino column, I mean, isn't the correct answer other? You know, I didn't know what the race of the person was, regardless of what the conversation would. Wouldn't you start seeing a lot of entries like that after a while in the Palm Pilot?
No, we're not seeing that. And what's happening is, if you're trying to track an individual officer, I don't think the data has much value. But if you're looking at institutional behavior, you would almost have to have an entire conspiracy to skew those numbers. And once again, understand that officers, we get paid to make those perceptions. When we get a suspect description, we're going to apply the same perception. In other words, if it's a female Hispanic, I got to make that perception that you're a female Hispanic to develop the reasonable suspicion or probable cause. So this is what we train them to do. This is what they get paid to do. And so they need to document that so we can get an idea. We're looking at institutional behavior, not whether an individual officer is racist or profiling, because I think the data won't show you that because there's too many other variables that are involved with benchmarking, and I think you should have other systems to attract that. But for institutional behavior, there is a lot to learn from data collection.
Our number 1-800-423-8255. Kyla is on the line.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I hate to sound like a, you know, just a polemic here, but I think that we're sort of avoiding the issue altogether. We're talking about a lot of symptoms, and we're talking about all the results of how people carry themselves and what they believe in society. We need to be reading like Ronald Zakaki and James Baldwin to look at this problem. Racism is endemic to our society. It is present in all of us, whether we're black or we're white. And to say that it isn't having a profound effect on how our criminal justice system is carried out is unbelievable. I think that Heather McDonald's comments are, I mean, they express a sort of willful, you know, ignorance of the racism that we all carry and inflict on each other at all times. I don't know if she's had the experience of being in a car when someone is stopped for racial profiling. I have white friends who've lost their licenses because they've refused to pay tickets they've gotten because they were simply stopped for driving black people in their car. My mother's an MD, and when people see her drive, she's black, driving a car with MD plates, she's stopped constantly outside her own building for no violation, not for double parking.
Well, let's have Heather McDonald answer that.
Well, you know, some of these anecdotes are undoubtedly true, and there are officers out there who, as individuals, are abusing their discretion.
But
some
Heather,
of them
hate,
are not.
I, you know,
some of them,
I, of
though, I think are the
not.
Basis of misapprehension.
Absolutely.
Where people believe, you know, you talk to officers and they'll say, if I pull over a black person, the first thing I hear is, you only stopped me because I'm black. And my response is, no, I stopped you because you ran a red light. So
but Heather, in New York City, the majority of white officers
Let's let Kyla finish, yes.
In New York City, the majority of white officers live in white suburbs and police black people in black neighborhoods. Like, it's not an issue of a stop or an anecdote. Those anecdotes are a long historical narrative of how things have happened in this country from its inception.
In New Jersey, there's absolutely no difference of the rate of stops between black and white troopers. People are stopping based mostly in
okay.
black
black
traffic.
People have that racism for themselves as well. It's what we're taught in society. As a woman of color, I've grown up in many ways, taught by my own black mother, to be suspicious of black men walking on the street at night.
And Kyla, I'm going to have to intervene here because we have to take a break from it. And I'll recall my own experience of doing a story traveling with, in fact, a black police officer in Baltimore. It wasn't a matter of whom he pulled aside. It was which license plates he was calling into the state computer, and it was whenever he saw a black man driving an expensive car, especially a young black man. That was, to him, an indication of something being wrong. In one case, it was actually a plainclothes cop. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, the strange and evolved...
It's The Connection. I'm Robert Siegel. The topic is racial profiling. Thanks to Kyla, who's been on the line for calling. And on to Sing Min, who's also on the line.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I've been robbed three times at gunpoint by young black males, and the last time was because I refused to engage in racial stereotyping, and I had a chance to cross the street and turn back. I didn't want to do that, and I said, look, I shouldn't be assuming that they are risky individuals. I just kept on walking, and they pulled out a gun and robbed me. And no one on the show is denying that the probability that a black person has committed a violent crime is not, nobody's denying that that probability is higher than the probability for a randomly selected white person. Is anybody else outside of the show credibly claiming that the differential in incarceration and arrest rates is only due to differential enforcement patterns?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's put that to Ron Davis in Oakland, because Heather McDonald did cite the numbers earlier that drug-related violent crimes, including murders, are disproportionately committed by minority members. Ron Davis, I mean, what do you think of what Sing Min has said?
Yeah, well, I think, and Heather is partly right. I mean, we are seeing a lot of black-on-black violence as a result of narcotics. But, you know, it's still, I have to say that that does not apply to the African-American race or blacks as a whole. And so our tactics to address that are not being effective because we're not, you know, we're not really resulting, we're not netting those arrests as a result of these car stops. And it's very hard not to apply a stereotype of bias. And I think the last caller hit it right on the nose that when we talk about racial profiling and biases, that the race of the officer is really not the issue. It's the race of the person being stopped. And so I have a saying that racial profiling is not necessarily about racism, but it is about race in America and how we perceive minorities. If we think they're engaged in more crime, if we think they are more, and I use the word they, and I emphasize that, it's how people talk, they are more violent. Not that there's more violence within our community because of narcotics, but we as a people are more violent, then we are prone to have these stereotypes and then react as a result of it.
But I wonder, Singmin, are you concerned that an abuse of police powers in one context might lead to poorer law enforcement that would create, alas, a fourth encounter that you might experience? Is that part of your concern?
My concern is twofold. One is that we have to make the argument clear to society, the linkage clear to society between discrimination and crime. And that, I think, perhaps two callers ago, a woman pointed out that there are underlying causes that are historical and social. And that, yes, it may be true that discriminatory law enforcement and discriminatory conduct by the rest of society can perhaps contribute to higher crime rates in the first place. So we have to look at the feedback effect. But at the same time, we have to sell to the community the argument that, hey, even, you know, we have to explain to the community, to the common person on the street, if we see a higher probability of crime among groups with certain characteristics, risk characteristics, why don't we devote more law enforcement resources to those areas or persons rather than just responding to risk behavior? So I think there's an argument there that has to be made. And maybe your police officer is saying, well, civil rights are more important than protection. We have to, is that in fact an argument that we can sell to the public?
Robert,
thank you very much. Yes, is that Heather?
Can I respond?
Yes.
I think in one sense we're oversimplifying how law enforcement works in this country. Let's get away from the highway situation and traffic stops and look at urban policing, which is the area that I'm most concerned about with this racial profiling.
Right. And community policing in New York, where there's a very sophisticated computer analysis of where crimes are and where to deploy police.
That's exactly right. And it says nothing about race. It looks only at where crimes are being committed, and it deploys officers there. It doesn't look at whether there's yuppies, you know, white yuppies that are demanding police protection, or whether there's black people there. It simply analyzes data. And a lot of departments across the country are doing this. The police are in certain neighborhoods because people are being killed and shot. And when they're there, they're not looking at race because often they're in predominantly minority neighborhoods. Again, as Ron says, they're looking at behavior and they're taking into account, is this corner a known drug location or is this a crack house? And they're looking at how people behave on the streets. Are they talking to each other? Do they run when they see an officer? Do they turn it, you know, go it quickly, change directions? And again, when we're going to be doing our data collection in an urban setting, this is when the benchmark problem just goes out of all control, because you're going to have to look at police strategies. Not only, you know, who are the violators and who's been stopped, but were the police doing an intensive drug enforcement or has there been a string of robberies, and are they doing intensive enforcement there? And you have to play that into your statistical model as well.
But in fact, Ron, your organization, the Black Law Enforcement Officers Executives, have actually, well, you've cited data about asking police about the same situation involving blacks and whites and how they would deal with the same situation.
Yes.
Police of all races, I gather, are much more likely to think the white guy involved in some armed encounter on a street corner in a seedy neighborhood is an undercover cop.
Yeah, what happened, let me first respond to what Heather said, because I do agree with her. One of the things for a benchmark has to be staffing deployment, because most deployments are based on calls for service and crime. And so if you have more officers in a minority community, they will conduct more stops, which will skew your aggregate data depending on how a municipality polices. And so when that's really up to the agencies to identify that at the beginning of the process, that if you have more officers in a certain area, it also depends on your population density, where your groups are residing. So there's a lot of variables that I think we are learning more and more about. But I think really the issue of profiling is not the fact that your data might be off some percentages, because we don't support that. We're not saying that it should be a perfect match with the census. That is so inaccurate, it's almost irresponsible. We want to address the issue of bias. And what I give police officers, I do training throughout the country, is a scenario for them to think about to really show them where their bias is. And I think once we show how we have biases, that our officers are good men and women, and they'll do an introspective look and adjust their behavior, because I don't think most cases it's really racism or malicious. And the scenario we give them is this. If you're going to that neighborhood that Heather's talking about, that's high crime, and unfortunately it might be predominantly minority, and you're a police officer and you see two male blacks standing in a corner, one's pointing a gun at another, what do you have? And they all pretty much say, well, you know, probably a robbery, a drug deal go bad. Then I reverse the situation and ask him, now what if the male white is pointing a gun at a male black? And there's hesitation, possibly an undercover cop, possibly a victim. That hesitation is bias. They made an assessment based on bias, which means the male black in the first situation is more likely to have force or deadly force applied than the male white. And the response was the same from both black and white officers. And so as we look around this country at profiling, we also have to look at things like these accidental shootings of minority officers who are undercover and off-duty. We have to address the issue of bias. And if we look at our symbol of justice, it's probably the key. The Lady of Justice is not blind. She's not free of bias. She's blindfolded. We have to change our systems to create those blindfolds so that officers do not unintentionally apply biases and go strictly by behavior of the individual. And if they do that, then really the numbers are irrelevant. But the numbers right now give us – it points a direction. Statistics only suggest.
Our number, I have to say right now, is 800-423-8255. I'm going to cut you off, Ron, because Carol is on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Carol.
I'm calling you from Worcester. And the question I have, or the comment I wanted to make, is not so much the racial biasing, but just general biasing. And the example from my family is that I have a niece who's 26 years old and is working on a PhD in chemistry at Penn State, at State College, Pennsylvania. And she has, in the last year or two since she's been there, been stopped mostly on weekends, I think she said, but about 2 o'clock in the morning as she drives from her office where she does research, and that's maybe the only time she can get lab time or that it's quiet and she'd like to be there. But she's on her way home and passes bars, and she has been stopped, as I say, 3 or 4 times by the same policeman. And she finally said, I mean, I don't know when she said, but she said, "Why are you always stopping me?" And he said, "I stop anyone who's traveling on this street after 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning because I assume they're drunk."
Jack McDevitt, is that a pretty common law enforcement scenario?
Well, I think it's really interesting because it is fairly common, and it's a little bit scary. One of the whole things, the benefits of this whole discussion, this whole getting data, is going to be we don't really know why an officer chooses to stop this car and not that car. What we do know is that most cars are speeding. The officer can choose to pick any one of these cars to stop, but they choose based on something. And as Ron says, it may be something that they're not even thinking about, some stereotype that society is in their head, and they choose to stop that car. What we're starting to see with some of the data that we're looking at is that there are other groups that are also being profiled. And one is women driving alone late at night. And the other one is, I'll give you an example. When I go and train police officers, I say, "Do you ever stop somebody because of race?" And they say, "Oh, absolutely not. Never. I would never do that." And then I say, "Do you ever stop anybody because of age?" And they say, "Oh, yeah, all the time." We always pull all the young people.
This always reminds me of the fictional drug dealer in Richard Price's novel Clockers, who made a point of driving a gray Volvo, which was his protection against being stopped by police. He was safe as long as he was seen in the Volvo. Thank you, Carol. Paul is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hello?
Yes, you're here.
Hi, this is Paul Marcus calling. I'm co-director of an organization in Boston called Community Change, and our focus is institutional racism. And it's interesting, as Heather talked, I think sometimes I feel we live in a different country. I'm sitting here in Boston where a few years ago we had the Stewart case, and not too long after that we had the case in Carolina with the woman who drove her 2 children into the water. We know the response of the police in those cases. And what I wanted to comment about is I think a general conception about what racism is, and I think most people out in the country think of racism as prejudice based on skin color. And when I'm talking about racism, I'm talking about a system, And I'm talking about a system in this country. I'm talking about a system of advantage for white people. And so we can be talking about racial profiling in the healthcare system. We can be talking about racial profiling in the legal system. We can be talking about racial profiling in the neighborhoods where we put where we have diesel buses in Boston, where kids are dying of asthma, and the decisions and the institutional decisions being made to make those in the neighborhoods we're talking about. In fact, why do those neighborhoods exist in this country mm-hmm. that has so much wealth? And so what happens here is we begin thinking about this as individual cases of people doing things, and we completely disregard the institutional nature of what's happening.
The institutional nature. Ron Davis?
Yes.
What do you say to that?
I think he's 100% right, and although the focus has been law enforcement, like I was telling you, the racial profiling is about race in America. I think what the data is going to show us at the end of the day is we can be able to probably distinguish between police-based stereotypes and societal-based stereotypes, because there will probably be some disparities that are a result of institutional racism and historical racism. And so, and that the officers cannot be held accountable for that. And that's what we have to try to figure out, is at what point are the officers applying bias, and at what point are the disparities based on a history of racism and oppression, if you will.
I think there's a whole set of voices that isn't getting heard, though. I go into community meetings in Harlem or Bedford-Stuyvesant, and what I hear exclusively is, why aren't you giving us more police? Why aren't you getting dealers off the street? There's revolving door justice. You arrest the guy and he's back on our streets the next day. People feel like the discrimination in the system is not too much enforcement, but people assume you're policing Park Avenue. You're allowing behaviors in our neighborhood because we're black that you would never allow on Park Avenue. And
you're saying that the relationship between victim or potential victim and criminal or potential offender is more important here than the similarity or the sameness of race between those two, and that is being heard by police officials. Also,
in my experience, police really care about the good guys versus the bad guys. They want to protect people of any race that are law-abiding. And I, you know, call me naive, but I've gone to a lot of police academy trainings. I've talked to a lot of officers. And, you know, my sense is that they really do care about protecting people of all colors. And they don't care, you know, if the guy is white or black or green, if his behavior is raising their level of suspicion, that's what they're looking for.
Heather McDonald, thank you very much. Heather
You're
McDonald
welcome.
Of the Manhattan Institute. Ron Davis, a very brief last word.
Yeah, just with the community part, and I get communities all the time that ask me about the deployment and more stopping more people, and community demands cannot dictate necessarily how we do the stops. And what happens is we've convinced a lot of minority communities that the only way for them to have safe streets are these overly aggressive tactics. And if you force the people to believe that the only way they can't be terrorized or be victims is to accept constitutional violations, then they're going to choose that. And we have to convince them that strategic responses, community policing, and partnerships reduce crime, not just doing random stops and searches of minorities. And we're forcing minorities to stereotype minorities.
Thank you very much, Ron, for that and for being with us. That's Ron Davis, head of the Racial Profiling Task Force of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. We also had Jack McDevitt, Associate Dean at Northeastern University's Center for Criminal Justice Policy Research with us. And earlier we heard from Raquel De La Rocha of the Los Angeles Police Commissioners Board. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Eliason Group, providers of IT consulting and staffing services to Fortune 500 companies and emerging startups.